It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a CDC advisory group is recommending the COVID vaccine be added to immunization schedules. We'll learn more about what impact that could have and look at some of the misinformation surrounding that decision. First, the pandemic forced a lot of people to change their shopping habits and make more of their purchases online instead of in-store. Some business analysts wondered if that change was going to become permanent as more people tried out online shopping for the first time. Turns out as the threat of the pandemic wound down, so did some of that online spending. Data from the U.S. Census Bureau shows that the growth of online sales was slowing down, while overall retail sales have continued to go up. That trend could shape the way businesses approach their retail operations in the future, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. How much of your shopping do you do in-store versus online? Did the pandemic change how you shop? If so, have you changed back? What are you doing differently? What are you doing the same? Call 800-642-1234. Tell us how you buy your stuff. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Hart Posen is a professor of management and human resources at the UW-Madison School of Business and an expert on business strategy. Hart, welcome back to not just Central Time, to the studio.
It's so good to be back.
It's been a while.
With you. It's great.
Got the band back together.
All right.
Now, we were talking, not in the studio, early in the pandemic, a lot of people new to online shopping. The big question mark was, is that going to stick? Are we training people? Are people picking up this habit? They're going to stick with it. Bad news for online stores. What are you looking at today?
Well, the habit is still growing, but in fact, we're gone back to growing at the pace we did before the pandemic. So when the pandemic hit, there was this big upward spike in online shopping for obvious reasons. But now if you look at the trend from before the pandemic, we've gone back down to that old trend line pretty much. So pretty much the pandemic effect on e-commerce overall was transitory. It went away, but we're still buying more and more online every year.
But it's that slow, gradual growth we saw before we heard of this pandemic, not that like exponential growth we saw during it.
That's exactly right. And this varies by sectors. For different sectors, the change has been different. But yes.
And one of the charts I saw with this census data was clothing sector. And man, oh man, and that it looks like we're exactly where we were before pandemic. We bought stuff online. We were apparently happy to do it, but I guess we're happier to go to a store and buy our clothes.
Well, yeah, you see this in a couple of ways. If you look at other data for clothing retail, you'll find that, in fact, clothing was one of the hardest categories hit by the pandemic. In terms of total dollar volume, after the pandemic eased off, retail sales of clothing skyrocketed and went back down. You know, there was a lot of pent-up demand for clothing, but part of it is we want to go to the store and try it on. And the data across very different segments, one piece of data I've seen recently, is maybe up to 2/3 of people or more want to go and try it on.
Now, one part of this story, too, was your online companies, Amazon in particular, really muscled up, hired people. Where I go to my grocery store, there were traffic jams because across the street was an Amazon distribution and all these Prime trucks going around. Concern now, I think, in the markets that they may have over-developed their facilities, their staffing, given what we're looking at now.
Well, Amazon has been hard hit lately. Their stock has dropped by about 1/3 since its peak, and they are scaling back on hiring. They're scaling back on some of the growth rate and distribution infrastructure, and we're starting to observe that. But don't think for a second that means anything negative for Amazon.
Right, they're not going to go away tomorrow.
Certainly not.
We're talking to Hart Posen from the UW-Madison School of Business, looking at how we buy things. The pandemic, online shopping went up a lot. Now we're seeing retail stores not doing so bad. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Want to hear your shopping evolution over the last couple of years? That's 800-642-1234. Joe joins us now in Lake Geneva. Joe, hi.
Hey, I just wanted to mention the fact that I actually prefer shopping in person now, just on account of the fact that, like, with a lot of Amazon deliveries and stuff are being stolen, and so it just, like, kind of takes that aspect out of the equation, you know?
Yeah. And Joe, I want to ask, did you, at any point during the pandemic, were you working from home, or were you in a job where that wasn't an option?
No, I've never had the option to work at home, no.
Okay, Joe, thanks a lot for bringing that up. I bring that up, Hart, because I think what the retail theft thing was, if I'm working at home all the time, I'm there when that package shows up. Porch Pirates, sorry, I'm bringing it in before you get there. If people like Joe never got to work at home, or people are going from home back to the office, maybe that worry is there about what happens to that package while I'm waiting to get home from work.
Yeah, and you know, folks have been trying to solve that in many ways, right? So our doorbell cameras have some effect, obviously. But Amazon has partnered, for instance, with one of the garage door firms to sell a product called MyQ that allows their drivers, you can opt to give their drivers access to your garage. And so folks are trying to solve it, but you know, that problem will never go away fully, right?
Joe, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Let's get back to my grocery shopping experience, Hart, because people
Absolutely.
Love to hear about that. A change happened. I often go in off hours to my big grocery store, and there's me and some other shoppers and then a bunch of store staff rounding up the groceries that somebody else ordered online. Can you talk about the ways the shopping experience, you know, when you're going to a store, has changed over the last couple of years?
Well, you know, these grocery stores had, you know, one of the most interesting things about the pandemic is it created this window of opportunity for folks in many industries, but retail in particular, to experiment. Things they would have rolled out slowly over many years and tried in a couple of stores to see how it worked, they had no choice but to roll it out rapidly. And one of the things that gets rolled out is, you know, whether it's a third party like Instacart or it's the store's own folks, using the stores as warehouses. And, you know, the way I talk about online retail versus in-person retail is in-person retail is designed to be a self-service warehouse, and online retail is a full-service warehouse, right? You go to this, it's self-service in the sense that, you know, Rob drives to the store, he parks his car, he gets a cart, he pulls his own stuff, puts it in the cart, carries it to the checkout, carries it out to his car. And, of course, online eliminates that task for you. But now what happens, I think your point is, what happens when they're not just using that store as a self-service warehouse, but using it as a full-service warehouse as well, with people with carts in the aisle professionally picking stuff? Mm-hmm. And guess what? It doesn't work very well. It doesn't work very well for the shoppers in the store, because Rob's being pushed out of the way by someone with a cart and a computer and a long list. And in fact, it doesn't work very well as an e-commerce platform, even though its feature is it's close to the customers. But you never quite know what's in stock in the store, because it might say there are three in the store, but three customers have them in their cart walking to the checkout. So sometimes stuff is in the store that you're not going to be able to buy online. Sometimes the stuff you want isn't there, and there's no means to tell you, here's a good substitute. Mm-hmm. There are all these problems with it. And so what folks are doing, in particular, this is true for Walmart, but I think for others as well, is, you know, for years they've been getting rid of the back room in their stores to make more shopping space. Mm-hmm. They're slowly putting some back room back so that they can use the proximity to their customers but have a separate storage area for a lot of items, because you don't want those people in the aisles. And so it was a really interesting period of experimentation where we learned a lot.
We're talking about retail online and in person with UW-Madison Business School professor Hart Posen. Online, of course, big in the early days of the pandemic. It's scaled back. Some people are getting back into stores for in-store shopping, even though it's changed in some ways. And we want to hear you at 800-642-1234. Did the pandemic cause any lasting changes in the way you shop? Did you become more willing to buy things online and have them shipped to you? Were there certain things that you still want to go into a store to buy in person? If you work in retail at a Amazon facility, say, or in a big box store or in a small retail store, what has changed in your work? Call 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with UW-Madison Business School Professor Hart Posen with us today, looking at the latest trend in retail sales, shifting away from online shopping after a big jump early in the pandemic, back toward physical stores. And we want to hear your own story at 800-642-1234. Did your shopping habits change early in the pandemic? Have those changes stuck, or did you go back? Do you do some kind of hybrid thing, order something online, pick it up at a store? Do you work in retail? Did you work in retail and you left it during all of this? Tell us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Labor shortages affecting everything, lots of lines of work. How has retail dealt with this?
This has been obviously really, really challenging broadly across retail, including obviously restaurants and other things. And boy, you see this in terms of, you know, we were at going someplace recently, and on the sign, the door said closed because they didn't have any staff. I think so we know where things stood and the rate at which, retailers had to increase wages. At the Target I go to, they had a sign, try and hire. And you could watch every few months starting salary number go up and up and up. I think the big question in everyone's mind now is what will be the implications of the recent increases, substantial increases in interest rates on that. And I think one hypothesis is that those shortages will be diminished as people feel pressure to come back into the workforce.
Now, one newer wrinkle than our earliest conversations about all this, Hart, is inflation sticking around for a while. Are you seeing that? Are we stopping buying stuff? Are we cutting back on things? It doesn't seem like the numbers show that.
They don't show it yet, but you should keep in mind that the Fed's goal, the Federal Reserve Bank, it is to slow consumer spending to cool down the economy. So, one take on it is rates will keep on going up until they feel their interest rate effect interventions bite on, amongst other things, consumer sales, consumer spending.
I mean, it seems like at some point we're going to have the Federal Reserve chair showing up in front of my local store trying to stop me getting in the door.
That's a nice image. You ought to draw a cartoon of that. That's good.
Now,
I like that.
On a more serious note, like over the last couple of years, some stores have closed. Smaller stores or chains have closed down. How much has gone away over the course of the pandemic?
I don't have those specific numbers on me, but I think that in many sectors, yes, a lot of stuff has gone away, but a lot of new stuff has popped up. Mm-hmm. And I think one way to think about this is that those businesses that were the most borderline to start with were obviously the most vulnerable. And as many of them quickly got swept away at the start of the pandemic, and clearly for those families that own those kinds of businesses, this is a tragedy. But as those firms got swept away, they've been replaced by others. And so you see certain regional and local restaurant chains growing. You see a lot of that. I think we should never forget that every time one firm goes away, something else comes in to take its place. And we may like it, we might not like it, but this is the process by which the economy finds new kinds of businesses and new kinds of enterprises and new kinds of products. And our economy over the last century has been very, very good at doing this.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us calling from upstate New York. Jim, hi.
Hi there. Hey, how's it going?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about, Jim?
Well, I'll tell you what. This is a fascinating program. First of all, we're addicted to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Great.
And I come at this from a couple of different perspectives. One is that my family and I, of course, like everybody else, pretty much relied on online ordering and buying during the pandemic, but also from the perspective of an architect who designs retail stores all over the country, for that matter. And of course, that portion of my business somewhat disappeared for a few months, but it came back. It's come roaring back, frankly. And a lot of it is, I said to your producer, we moved from a very large city to a very small village. And part of it is because we love that that interaction between ourselves and the person behind the counter, as well as running into other people. And that's part of what, I really miss that part. We lived in Minneapolis for many years, and to run into friends and so on in the various stores. And we miss that. And I think I see that coming back in a lot of people. And I think a lot of people are feeling guilty about their downtowns kind of turning into nothing, and realize that they are the answer. And it's been very interesting.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Hart, you're nodding along there.
Yeah, no, I fully agree. If you go back to the late 1990s and the early 2000s, you saw people talking about how maybe eventually one day online will replace stores. This mentality went on until maybe about 8, 7, 6 years ago, where folks started to think more richly about something we now call omni-channel retailing. There'll be many different points of contact. And the idea that a store is not a substitute, or online retail is not a substitute for physical retail, but a complement to. And I think the trick, as if it were easy to do, for these retailers is to find a store configuration that can make this work. So there's recently news from Macy's, the department store, and they found that for years they had been reducing stores, but they found a significant complementarity. Where they had stores, their online retail was most productive. They're not substitutes, they're complements. And just this social interaction in the physical stores, it's not just trying stuff on, but social interaction, which is innate to our human character, is clearly very important. And you commented that you're a retail architect. Boy, you folks are important now, because now we have to figure out a whole bunch of new things, not just what the front of the store looks like, but what the back of the store looks like to facilitate that complementarity between e-commerce and physical stores to make it work really well.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234, talking about the recent past, the present, and future of how we shop online versus in person. Online came on strong for a while there. In person, doing pretty good now, it looks like. Still time for you to call, if you call quickly, at 800-642-1234. Hart, what are you watching for next? What are some of the big open questions for you right now?
I the thing that interests me most is to see which of these experiments that were undertaken during COVID stick around. The most notable one for me, because I go to a Target that's not too far from my house, is, and many places have it, these parking spots in front for in-store pickup. And the question is, how will this in-store pickup be done? To what extent are they able to rework that store to create inventory that's for the online, that doesn't interfere with the storefront shopping experience? And the Target and others went to that store pickup very fast. But I don't think the way we see it now is the way it's going to be, or the way it's going to look in 3 years or 5 years. And I'm very interested to see how that changes.
Interesting. We've got time for one more caller, actually. Randy is with us in Ripon. Randy, hi.
Hi. I just kind of wanted to back up the last caller. I used to, back in the 70s and 80s, when we had all these catalogs in order, and I went back to my local stores as well as, you got to go to the big box, but I prefer the small business owner, the small lumber yard. I like, to me, service has value. It isn't just price. It's the service I get. To me, that means something. So that's all I had to say.
Randy, thanks a lot. I don't think that's uncommon, Hart. How can that smaller business owner in particular tap into that sentiment from Randy?
Well, you know, I think they're working very hard at it. But I guess what I would add to what Randy said, because I agree with him, is that many large retailers are also recognizing that service matters. And there are different types. There are Walmarts where service is not a big thing. But there is Costco where I think if you're a Costco shop, you'd recognize that the kind of service you get there is important as well. So I think it's important not only for small local retailers, but I think it's important for many large established retailers as well. And I for one, am willing to pay for service. And so I fully agree with the caller.
Thanks a lot for that call. Hart, in just our last minute or so, do you think that steady climb, not that huge jump we saw, that steady climb in online will probably continue into the future?
Absolutely, because the best retailers are trying to figure out how to make this complementarity between e-commerce and physical stores work. We are going to see a bigger presence in physical stores of online retailers. They're going to do more and more of it. And that climb will continue, but we will never see a world where it's 100% e-commerce or not even close.
Hart, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Great to be back.
That's Hart Posen, professor of management and human resources at the UW-Madison School of Business, with us today to talk about consumer behavior trends and an apparent shift in retail. The online surge early in the pandemic, well, people are going back to in stores a lot more. Still time for you to share your thoughts, your shopping experiences, by the way, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a Wisconsin public health doctor about the COVID-19 vaccine being added to the recommended immunization schedule. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear from the leader of a Wisconsin effort to boost student voter turnout in this year's midterm elections. Now, a CDC advisory group voted last week to recommend the COVID-19 vaccine be added to the immunization schedules for children and adults. The move does not mean that schools will require the vaccination, though some misinformation to that effect has circulated on social media and elsewhere. Some states and schools do use the vaccine schedules to set their guidelines for students, but those decisions are made at the state or local levels. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the recommended vaccine schedules? Have you run into misinformation, or do you have questions to see if something is true or not? Would you like to see Wisconsin require the COVID-19 vaccine in the future? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Jonathan Tempty is the Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He served on the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. That's the panel that voted last week to add the COVID-19 vaccine to the immunization schedules. Dr. Tempty, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much, Rob. It's always a pleasure to join you.
Can you talk about these vaccine schedules? What are they? How do they work?
Absolutely. The vaccine schedules are created by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. They're reviewed and endorsed by CDC, but these set the roadmap for the complicated vaccine schedules that we have and provide clinicians like myself, people in pharmacies and so on, the appropriate information as to what vaccines to give at what age. More importantly, these are not only endorsed by CDC, but there is buy-in by the other groups out there that take care of patients in the country. So for example, the childhood schedule, this is one that goes from birth through age 18, is agreed upon by the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Academy of Family Physicians, and the CDC. On the other hand, the adult schedule that takes care of everybody else is agreed upon by the family physicians, the American College of Physicians, that's the internal medicine docs, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and the Nurse Midwife Association. So these are not only put together by CDC, but they're also broadly supported by all the immunizing communities out there.
There's been a lot of concern, I think, or confusion maybe about the link between the CDC putting this on the schedule and schools requiring the vaccines that are on that schedule. What are the steps in between those two things?
Well, there are a lot of steps, and it's usually a pretty complicated and complex procedure. The schedules themselves provide us the roadmap of what we should be doing in terms of providing people with the best evidence-based preventive care we can. But it's up to the states to determine whether or not any particular vaccine should be mandated. And let me take a step back, that for adults, we really don't have any mandates at all, with the exception for people who are in healthcare settings. Their healthcare system can require immunization, for example, influenza or COVID-19. On the other hand, children, because they are located within areas with high transmissibility, you know, congregated in schools, states have taken on the purview to, from time to time, mandate a vaccine for the safety of the school community.
Here in Wisconsin, can you talk about the process for requiring this particular vaccine, say, and not that other one? For example, I think the CDC guidelines recommend a flu vaccine. Last I checked, I don't think that's required, for example, for schools.
Yeah, I don't know of anywhere in the country that has a requirement for children to get influenza vaccine. But in the state of Wisconsin, it's a straightforward process, but usually takes a long time. It's something that is done on an executive branch level. So, you know, the governor's office and the secretary of the Department of Health Services will formulate the rules. And then it has to go to the legislature for approval. These things usually will take anywhere from 1 to 3 or 4 years to go through. And because it's proposed doesn't mean that it's going to happen. There's a lot of steps in there. So the rules that we do have, or the mandates, have been well thought out and exist for the benefit of all.
We are talking to Dr. Jonathan Tempty from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at vaccines for kids and adults, looking at new CDC recommendations for COVID-19 vaccines in particular. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. So Dr. Tempty, let's get into what exactly is the CDC recommending. Let's start with kids. What are they suggesting and when?
This is where it gets really difficult, because currently we have, for children, 3 different vaccines that can be used for COVID-19. We have the Pfizer, BioNTech, the Moderna, and the Novavax vaccines. And when I do teaching on this, I now have a table that has 10 different cells, depending on the vaccine and the age range, as to what you can do. But in general, what the recommended vaccine table will provide is the guidance for providing COVID-19 primary vaccine and boosters at the appropriate ages. But again, this really depends on how old you are. And you have to go not off the table, but to the footnotes in the table to get the nuances of exactly when, you know, how many doses, and how long you have to wait to provide a booster dose. So it gets fairly complicated, and far more detail than we want to put on the air right now.
Fair enough. Now, for that doctor who's working with parents, say, on a well-child visit, does this change much? We already have these vaccines available and some guidelines on how to use them. Does this additional recommendation now from the CDC advisory committee change how a doctor would talk to parents about these vaccines?
I don't think it changes very much in terms of what the doctor or other care provider mentions about vaccines. But I have to say that there's one really profound effect that having this on the tables has. And as we all know, all of us who have received a COVID-19 vaccine so far have gone into University Health Service for me, or to Walgreens for my last booster, or to your clinician office. And none of us have had to pay anything for the vaccines. This is likely to change in the very near future. The federal government will no longer be footing the bill for vaccines, and these can be expensive. I've seen reports of the Pfizer vaccine going to be coming out probably at $130 a dose. So when a vaccine goes onto the table, and there's something else called a vaccine for children resolution. When these things are enacted, all of a sudden, it requires the insurance industry to pay for the vaccine. If there is a vaccine that is routinely recommended and on the recommended vaccine schedule, then there's a mandate that the vaccine is paid for. And the reason this is really profound is, number one, not everybody can afford vaccines. We live in a country where there is a great range of incomes, and there will be people who would have to decide whether or not they would pay for a vaccine or to get food, buy gas for the car. So this is really, really important in terms of assurance that everybody has equal access to these vaccines.
Now, how about the CDC recommendations for us grownups? Anything change in these new guidelines from the CDC?
Well, simply by going onto the table, it also requires the vaccine to be covered under the Affordable Care Act on what we call a first dollar coverage. That means you don't have a deductible. It means you don't have any copay. So as long as it's on the recommended vaccine schedule, we also have an ability for this vaccine to be covered.
We're talking to Dr. Jonathan Tempty, Associate Dean of Public Health at the UW School of Medicine, about the COVID-19 vaccine being recommended on the immunization schedules for children and adults. This unanimous vote from an advisory board for the CDC. We're talking about what that does and what it doesn't mean for who gets vaccinated, for requirements at schools, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. As we mentioned, this doesn't mean that schools are requiring COVID-19 vaccinations. Would you like them to, or would you like them to stay, in effect, voluntary for kids? Do you have questions about the state of the art of what we know about vaccines, the new booster for particular variants of COVID-19? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Dr. Jonathan Tempty, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, with us today to catch up on the latest COVID-19 vaccine news, including a CDC advisory group recommending the vaccine for the standard immunization schedule. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about what that means? Have you run into claims in the media or social media? You're wondering if they are legit or not. Do you have questions more generally about what we know about vaccines now, what the current recommendations are? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Sandra is with us in Northern Illinois. Sandra, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to ask about, Sandra?
Just a little bit of confusion. I'm literally scheduled to get my Pfizer booster tomorrow, and I just spoke to a cousin who's scheduled to get the Moderna tomorrow. He said he has read the Moderna booster will cover the variant that is now happening in Europe that is beginning to show up here, but he is not, he hasn't heard anything about whether the Pfizer booster will. So I'm confused about which booster I should get.
Sandra, thanks for the call. If Sandra's confused, I imagine other people are too. Dr. Tempty, what do we know about the current boosters and what they're going to cover especially well?
Well, Sandra, the confusion is really widespread just because this has been such a dynamic and rapidly changing world out there. But both of the boosters that are approved now by FDA and are recommended by CDC are what we call bivalent boosters. They contain elements of the very original strain and elements of the BA4, BA5. So these should be reasonable vaccines to get at this time. The BA4, BA5 are both Omicron variants. And because of that, we get a broader immune response than from the original vaccine. So you should be fine with either Moderna or Pfizer.
Sandra, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Dr. Tempty, for that person who has had, you know, the original round and maybe the first boosters out there, can you talk a little bit about this new variant booster and the difference it can make given, as you said, this changing viral landscape?
Well, it's very interesting because as we have seen this virus evolve and change, we're not only seeing a different realm or a different spectrum of symptoms, but we're also seeing different spectrum in terms of, you know, things like case fatality rates, how many people are dying of this, what's the likelihood of hospitalization. But I think as time goes on, the vaccines have to adapt to what the variants we are encountering are at this point in time. And so with the mRNA technology, this allows a pretty rapid response, but it requires ongoing surveillance, not only here in Wisconsin, United States, but across the world, not only to see what we have, but to see what's emerging. And this will be a changing environment, I would say, you know, at least for the coming months to coming years. And the vaccine we have for a booster a year from now is probably going to be different from what we have now, but we just don't quite know where we're going to be.
Thanks again for that call, Sandra, at 800-642-1234. Dr. Tempty, I think in a lot of people's minds, COVID is on the back burner in some ways, and in part because there's some good news. The rates of people getting it are down. The death rate is down, but it's not gone. When you look at the charts, you know, we've been hovering at about 400 plus or minus deaths per day in the United States. That is definitely not nothing. How much concern do you have right now?
Well, in each of those 400 deaths per day represent, you know, multiply by 4 or 5 or 10 the number of people who are being really closely and personally affected. And then you have to think in terms of the resources behind for every death. There are numerous people who are hospitalized that are in ICU. You have all the caregivers, all the people who are, you know, putting in extra hours to care for these people in hospital, in nursing homes, and so on. So the toll is just immense, both in terms of the economic cost, but in the sheer human cost. So yes, this is far from over. And this is still continuing to be much more intense than your typical influenza outbreak. I think if you've been following the news over the last couple of weeks, we are also seeing influenza starting to come back, particularly in the southern states, and it will move up to Wisconsin. We're also seeing a lot of respiratory syncytial virus. This is one that really plays havoc with young children and older people. And we're seeing both influenza and RSV coming aboard much earlier than we typically do in a typical year. So I think the concern is if we're already having hospitals somewhat occupied by COVID, and then you start throwing on top these other respiratory infections, we could be dealing with a lot of just congestion in the hospitals, a lot of services that we just can't provide. So I think we have to be very, very careful. And that's my plug right now to remind people to get their influenza vaccine if you haven't get it as soon as possible.
Let's bring on another caller at 800-642-1234. Lenny is with us in Lake Geneva. Lenny, hi.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
What did you want to ask about, Lenny?
You know, I was vaccinated originally over a year ago, a couple of times. I haven't had any boosters. I'm 68 years old. I'm really healthy. However, I found out that I have atrial fibrillation, which is a heart condition. Been ablated twice. I'm in good shape now. But some of these vaccines, it seems as though there's been some heart issues that have dropped out of them. And I'm wondering if this vaccine is safe.
Lenny, talk about that. Thanks. Dr. Tempty.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. What we have found is at a low level, the mRNA vaccines, so the Moderna and the Pfizer, can be associated with what we call myocarditis or pericarditis. This is inflammation of the heart tissue. The good news in two ways is, number one, it's very rare. Number two, it's largely hit young males, so adolescent and males in their 20s. By the time you get into your 50s and 60s, this phenomenon pretty much has disappeared. It also has not really appeared in individuals younger than about 12 years old. So for your case, I wouldn't be particularly concerned in terms of the atrial fibrillation and issues along that line.
Thanks a lot for that call, Lenny. And Dr. Tempty, that myocarditis risk you mentioned, especially for younger men, we also must have to, I think, compare that to the risk of myocarditis that you get from having COVID itself, right?
Absolutely. And again, one has to be careful because the information is constantly changing. And what we know from the original strain, the pre-Delta, the Delta, the Omicron, the information keeps on changing, and researchers, people who are out there doing epidemiology, are constantly trying to keep up with this. But the bottom line is that the myocarditis we're seeing, you know, per immunization provided, is far less of a risk than the myocarditis per case of COVID acquired by an individual. So I think in terms of the risk benefit, the vaccines truly are very, very beneficial.
I wanted to ask, you mentioned the risk of flu and the need for flu vaccine. I think a common question people have is, can I get the flu vaccine as at the same time as a COVID initial vaccine or booster? I assume that's okay because I call it flustered. I got my flu vaccine and the Omicron booster at the same time. That's cool, right?
Yeah, that should be fine. Actually, this has been studied in the past. And we find that when both influenza vaccine and the COVID vaccine are provided together, both are immunogenic, meaning you get immunity from both of them, and it doesn't increase the level of side effects that you get above either of the vaccines.
And you mentioned earlier I think it was the Novavax vaccine. If I have this right, that's not an mRNA one like Pfizer or Moderna is. Is there a case where I'd want to say I want the mRNA versus the other kind?
Well, I think at this point in time, the Novavax, you know, provides an opportunity for people who wish to avoid the mRNA. The current Novavax vaccine is built off the original virus. And so we don't have yet a booster for the Novavax. However, CDC says that if you have received your initial two doses of Novavax, you can get a booster with the Pfizer vaccine following that.
Dr. Tempty, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and hopefully everybody remembers to get their flu vaccine as well.
That's Dr. Jonathan Tempty, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He's with us today to check in on the latest COVID-19 vaccine news, with the CDC advisory group recommending it be added to immunization schedules for children and for adults. coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. It's Mushrooms and Beyond. Explore the strange science of fungus life forms with the author of the book, The Hidden Kingdom of Fungi. And if you have questions about mushrooms and other fungus, this is your chance. Email ideas@WPR.org. And then join the conversation tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Okay, a few moments ago, I said a word that always makes me think twice about how you pronounce it. It's the word for more than one fungus, F-U-N-G-I. I always got to think, do I pronounce it fungi or fungi? As I often do, I looked it up in an online dictionary and found that the correct answer to the question of fungi or fungi is yes. Turns out they're both acceptable pronunciations. That's good news and bad news. Good news, I get it right either way. Bad news, a lot of people will think I got it wrong either way. It's an occupational hazard. Here's one that came up, though, long before I was on the radio. A friend of mine used to say the word theater as theater. And there was a good-natured dispute about that. We looked it up in the dictionary, a book kind. We didn't have the internet dictionaries at that point. The answer is theater is an acceptable alternative pronunciation, more common in the southern United States. He's from Marinette, though, pretty far from the southern U.S. If you have a unique pronunciation that you stick with, let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.